It's February 15th, 2017. Masoret.
We're in Shemos, chapter 10. I guess you might call it a confrontation between Paro and Moshe. This takes place after, or as a result of, the plague of darkness. And the Chumash describes it. It wasn't just that everything was dark, that the sun didn't come out that day, but it was a special type of a darkness, and it was extremely thick. It would appear, because people could not move. Apparently, they were paralyzed. It's hard to. I mean, it's not impossible to imagine, because I must have told you. Yeah, I think it was the first year I was out here. They have these dust storms. And, I mean, it's just a fraction of what the Egyptians went through, but it's a similar type of phenomenon. It's not just that it's dark. You can move, but, you know, you really... It's first of all, it's extremely dark. It's more dark than on a usual night. And, you know, you could basically feel it. Of course, the air becomes completely filled with dust. Now, I told the people that I know, you can imagine. You could have some type of a imagination of what happened in Egypt, except, obviously, it was tremendously greater, you know. To the point where a person couldn't even move. Okay, then it says, L'chol b'nei Yisrael hayor b'mosh vosam. And for all the B'nai Yisrael, there was light in their... What does that mean? What does that mean, basically? That in their homes... Well, that's an interesting one. Because what does that mean? That it didn't affect... Was it just in their homes? I mean, because in general, the Jews lived in this place called Goshen. So it's possible to say that this plague did not affect that area. Rashi says a little bit differently. There's a very interesting Rashi on this. Because... He says, let's take a look at Rashi. That's Rashi on Chaf Beis. Vahi Choshech Afela. There was a Afela. It was an extreme darkness. V'yamesh Choshech. Choshech is what the Pasuk says. That it's like palpable. All right. And then Moshe stretched out his hand, and there was a choshech afela, which is translated as a dense darkness. So Rashi says, choshech shel ofel, a darkness of ofel, shel oro ish es echav osan shloshes yom, that... person could not see his brother. I guess it mentions brother because generally, Eve, people that you're familiar with, you can, I mean, that's the criteria in terms of in the morning, at what point can you put on that tzitzis, for example, because it says you shall see them. So this is even before sunrise. Because from dawn is the earliest point at which it's considered morning. Even though you're not supposed to daven at that point, you're supposed to, davening actually begins with sunrise. That's the prime time to say the Shemona Esrei at sunrise. But permission is given, since it's considered to be daytime officially from the point of dawn, so there are situations in which you're permitted to daven. For example, if you're traveling. If you're traveling and you won't be able to daven shachris. You're going to be on the road or whatever it is. So then you could daven from dawn. Say you daven at your house and then you leave because special permission is given. Or you daven. There are plenty of times I've davened at the airport because I had to leave early and get to the airport and check in, and then you have a waiting time because it's very uncomfortable to daven on the plane. So I'd rather daven, in the waiting, the gate area. So you daven at dawn. But the time after dawn that you're permitted to put on, it's interesting. If you do it that way, you can't put on the tefillin, towels and tefillin at dawn, even though you could daven, because that's governed by other criteria. The criteria is when you can see your friend at a distance of dalat amos, of 4 amos. And they say a friend, it's not a friend that's that close to you, but not that this. Because the point being that the ability to recognize others has to do with familiarity. So, a person who's a total stranger, you need more light, so to speak. But someone that you're familiar with, you just pick up on very much, much more easily because you're very familiar with the person. So here it's Air Rashi is saying that a person didn't see his brother, which means like it's an absolute blackout. I mean, it's an absolute darkness where you can't see anything. Okay. Then Rashi goes on. He says, then there was another 3 days where there was a choshech that was even double this. See, it's interesting the way Rashi learns it. Rashi learns that there were two distinct phases. One was purely where they couldn't see anything. But then, of course, the Chumash also says that they couldn't move. So he says that it was broken down into stages. That is, the first you had the 3 days of absolute darkness. Then you had 3 days of a choshech, which was double the intensity. Shelo kam u'ish mitachtav, that a person could not rise up. Yoshev ein yochol lamod, someone who was sitting couldn't stand. V'yomeid ein yochol leishev, and someone who was standing couldn't sit. That's really very, graphic. Can you imagine a thing like that? So a person stood in his place. Well, he was standing. If he was sitting, he remained sitting. I guess that person was better off, because at least he was sitting. And the person who was standing had to stand for 3 days. Now, what about bodily needs? What about eating and drinking and other, functions of the body? I guess you have to use your imagination. Rashi doesn't have to bring it out. I guess you have to use your imagination. You have the element of blindness, that a person can't see anything. Now, for 3 days, that's bad enough. But apparently, he holds that in the first 3 days, they were not paralyzed. They weren't immobilized. They could move. Okay, so you're sort of like groping along. When you're in a situation like that, you're groping along. But you can't see anything. And that itself is a very, very, even though you can physically move, you're afraid to take a step. You don't know what you're going to bang into. Actually, I remember we used to drive to Chicago when we were in New York, a couple of times a year, and to visit my son. And driving through, I don't even remember the route anymore, but there was area where there was mountains, and it used to get really foggy. There were times when it got extremely foggy. I remember there was one time, it was so dark, I mean, driving in the car with the lights on, could not see ahead of you. I mean, you had to like pull over and wait until the fog lifted a little bit, just so you could drive carefully. But there was, I remember, a point where you're driving completely blind. So that's obviously, if you're in a car and you drive, it's a scary thing. But that's what Raji's saying over here, that in the first 3 days, they could move, but they couldn't see anything. They could not identify. I would imagine that they could communicate, though. Doesn't say anything about that. So, like, let's assume you're in your house. It's hard to imagine that because it's in your house and you put lights on. But apparently, and what about putting on the lights? In those days, of course, they were fires. Apparently, they couldn't do so. Or maybe even if they did, it didn't promote. Because here it wasn't just a matter of light; it was a matter of that thickness, that in the air, maybe the lights didn't even function. And then he says that they had another 3 days. It got worse. It's interesting how it did. It got worse. That too has an effect upon a person psychologically, because you know whenever you're suffering from something, at least you sort of have some kind of an attitude that if you get through this, you know, things will get better. That's the attitude that people have. Things will get better. But then they go through that phase, or things will change. And here it does change, but it changes for the worse, which is another dimension of fear. Because then there's the element of panic and what's going to happen next. So, continuing with Rashi, so Rashi says, "V'loma hevi aleihem choshech." Why did God bring darkness upon them? Okay, I don't know if he asks this question by all the other plagues. Why this? Why that? But he's asking it over here. He says, "Shehayu b'Yisrael b'yoso hador." That there are among the Jews of that generation, poshim, sinners, shlohayu rotzim latzeis, who didn't want to leave. Umesu b'shloshes yemei afela. And they die in the 3 days of darkness. Kidei shlo yiru mitzrayim b'mapalosam, b'mapaltam, so that the Egyptians shouldn't see their downfall, the Yomru, and they would say, Afheim Lokin Kamonu. They too are getting smitten like us. That's interesting. That's the first. Rashi gets two answers. That's the first answer. Let's do both, then we'll see if we can make sense out of it. V'yod Shechavshu Yisrael, V'ro as Kalehim. I think everybody's familiar with this one. He says, in addition, the Jews were able to, search, scope out, so to speak, and to see what their possessions. U'kashayatsu, when they left, v'hayushu'alamehen, and they would ask them, this is a whole different take on what took place when the Jews went to the Egyptians, and according to the instruction of Moshe, requested as borrowing or requested as gifts. That's a whole other discussion. That were the Jews entitled to keep all the wealth that the Egyptians gave? Did they give it with the intention that it would be a loan, or did they give it as a complete matana? There's a few different interpretations on that. But according to this interpretation, this would portray the Jews as being a little bit more bold. Of course, it says that when they left, and they would ask them the gifts for them, so they would say, we don't have anything. According to this interpretation, the Egyptians were not as generous. The Pasuk indicates they were extremely generous. That's the sense you get from the Pesukim. because they wanted, you know, God had placed the favor of the Jews. They had a very, very positive attitude, which is another miracle that takes place, an attitude of admiration to the extent that they wanted to give them. That's the sense you get from the psukim. But here Rashi is giving a slightly different, it seems to me anyways, a slightly different take. And that is, well, I'm sure there were, you know, again, when the Torah describes something, it's a general. It's not really a contradiction. Because when the Torah says that they, referring to Egypt, it's referring to them in general. So whenever you make a generalization, and it's a true one, you know, that a certain development and the people are very, very favorable towards something. Or the people support. It doesn't mean every particular individual. It never means that. There's always going to be groups, factions, that certainly individuals that are different, don't go along with it. So, according to this, Rashi's saying that there were those, and it makes sense. It makes sense because it is a very strange phenomenon. I mean, it doesn't get that much attention. I don't think people spend too much time talking about it. But it is a strange phenomenon. It's not a bad idea to discuss it at the Seder or something, because generally speaking, who's going to do that? People are reluctant to give away their, and this is their jewelry, you know, this is their expensive stuff. So people just give it away, even to lend it out, their best garments and their best jewelry is a very, very strange phenomenon. It's not something that, you know, sure, of course, I've seen that happen many times. You know, I don't see that. So it's something which requires an explanation. But here he's saying, you see, the reaction of these people makes more sense. It makes more sense. That is, they denied that they had anything. They would ask for specific things. They denied. That we understand. But it's interesting, even according to this interpretation, they had to deny that they had. But they couldn't. Why'd they have to deny? They could have said no. So you see that there was a tremendous pressure that these people felt as well to give. They were in conflict. Because they couldn't, for some reason, they couldn't just say, no, I'm not going to lend you, you know, that dress or that, whatever, ring or whatever the case may be. That they felt they couldn't do. But they, you know, that's what many people do. When, you know, someone calls you for some kind of favor and they need something and you're in conflict, you don't want to do it. So you generally, if possible, you try to deny that you have it. So that's what they said. Ein bi'adeinu klum. We don't have anything. Omer lo, then he would say to him, Ani re'isiv b'veischa. I saw it in your house. V'makom plonihu. And it's in that, and he would point out where it was. So first of all, what's the point of this Rashi? But from this Rashi, see, the question is, what does it mean when it says that for the Jews there was light in their dwellings? How are we supposed to understand that? Does that mean that it affected one place, but it didn't affect the other place? It didn't affect the place where the Jews were. But if that's the case, then this wouldn't make sense, because if a Jew entered the place where there was darkness, then it should be the same thing for him as well. But here you see that for the Jews it was light. That is, they were in the exact same place of where the Egyptians were. And for the Egyptians, they were in complete darkness, and they were completely could move, but the Jews were able to move freely. That's a hard one to understand. That is, that's something which would be contrary to the laws of nature. But all right, so that's how Rashi is learning. That for whatever reason, it didn't affect the Jews. Now, what's the point that he's made? What's the bigger point? He raises the question about the purpose of this plague of darkness. And it does seem to be in a different category, because all of the other plagues which come before this are essentially different ways in which the land is being smitten. The surroundings are being smitten. You know, the hail, and even after the hail, there was whatever vegetation was left was consumed by the arba, the locusts. This seems to be in a different class, because nothing here is really being smitten. But this seems to be pretty much directed towards the people. That the, of course it's darkness, but it's not the dark. It's not destroying anything. It's just that it's immobilizing the people. It's directly aimed at the people. But Rashi has a strange explanation. I mean, I guess the other ones, to a certain extent, were not all consuming and absolute. You could kind of escape it. There was always a little bit wiggle room left. Like, for example, in the Barad. So Moshe warned. He warned them in advance. And he said, whoever fears God will bring in your slaves, bring in your cattle, you know, your animals, whatever you have out in the fields, because it's going to get destroyed. And the Pasuk does say that the one who feared God, I mean, there were different groups. There were people that, by this point in time, had already reached a point where they recognized God, and they listened to Moshe, and they brought their property in from the fields, and was saved. And those who didn't, I mean, Paro wasn't the only one that was stubborn. There were other people as well that didn't. And they, it's an interesting phenomenon. See, because I guess that most people don't think for themselves. They don't think for themselves. They follow the trends. Like you see in the country today, you know, there's groupthink. So right now, you know, you have the people that are opposed to Trump. So they just get out there and yelling demonstration. If they're interviewed, they don't even know, basically even understand what the problem is and why they're doing all these things. What's the problem? Why are they so opposed? They just go along and they accept the slogans of the group. So I guess that's the same thing in Egypt. You have Paro, as long as Paro was, I guess you'd call him a refusnik, he was refusing and so on and so forth, so that became the official line. So then, no, because the question is, why didn't everybody bring in their cattle? Because no, they refused, they went along with that, that's the official line. They didn't think for themselves. But the one who was a yare, who was afraid, you have people that think for themselves. And they didn't go along with the official doctrine that the Paro was still in a state of denial. They thought for themselves. And then they brought their animals in. So they saved their property. Now, getting back over here to the Choshech. The Choshech, it would seem that there was no escape. This was directed at the heart of the people. And, I mean, it was different. It was different than the Makas Bechoros, you know, the killing of the firstborn. It was different. But it would seem that in terms of the whole purpose of it was to instill a certain type of fear. I mean, you can imagine that would be like a experience of terror. Because, you know, the dark, everybody's afraid of the dark. And you're afraid of the dark and all the inconveniencing. And then for another 3 days, you simply can't move. So that has to engender, and you're totally helpless. It's putting them into a state of fear and total helplessness. It's interesting why this didn't produce the result of Machas Bechoros. I mean, they couldn't... Machas Bechoros, there was, you know, that very night, you know, the people were in a state of hysteria. And Paro came, you know, to search for Moshe. He wanted him to leave that very night. But here... Well, I guess there was nothing they could do. They couldn't even go out and protest. They couldn't even go out. You had no one to go to. The entire structure of society shut down completely. You would think, though, that this would be the one. After they went through this, they'd had enough. Okay. But what Rashi is saying is that... Two reasons why Choshech. It just seems a little funny. One was because this was a night, and we don't talk about that too much either, but one of the tasks, so to speak, that had to be done was to deal with the Jews that didn't want to go. Okay? So we learned from this that there were Jews that didn't, interesting, there were Jews that didn't want to go along with the Jews when they left Mitzrayim. And there were Egyptians that did go along, the Erev Rav. Okay, so there were Jews that didn't want to go along, and that's the first thing. Then apparently Hashem wanted to eliminate them. Okay, that's the second thing. But when Hashem eliminated them, he didn't want the Egyptians to be cognizant of it. So those are the three things we have to address. Let's see if we can make sense out of that. Why let's assume that there were. That's not hard to envision, that there were Jews who didn't want to go. I mean, the question would be, well, why not? Don't you want to leave? And it's not as if things are so great for the Jews in Egypt. That's not so simple. I mean, Jews in America today, you know, they're not in any hurry to go to Israel to make Aliyah. While, you know, Jews from other parts of the world, the bulk of the Aliyah comes from other parts of the world where Jews, generally speaking, where Jews have it rough. When Jews are, like in Europe now or in France, when Jews are feeling the pressure of anti-Semitism and so forth, so they tend to move. But where the Jews have it well, they're going to tend to stay until things change. I mean, hopefully before it's too late. But why would that be? You think that the Egypt, you know, they'd want to leave. They were slaves. You'd think they want to leave. So that's the first question. And then the next question would be, who cares? So let them stay. Why would they be killed for that? For not wanting to go? And of course, the third question would be, so why must that be in secret? When, to the contrary, let it be known publicly. That wouldn't that be a further indication that God controls the world? Okay, so let's deal with that. I think that what Libby is saying makes a lot of sense. Because you could see that. We could see the same thing. That in spite of the fact that the Jews essentially were slaves, but I mean, Egypt was a great power. And that's the effect of the assimilation. They regarded themselves as Egyptian. And I would imagine that they found, you could see, for example, the way the Jews looked at the situation of the enslavement, how they rationalized it. There was an element of rationalizing. Because, you see, for example, when the immediate reaction of Paro was to Moshe, was to punish the Jews, basically, by refusing to grant them straw for the bricks. And I was just discussing this with Rabbi Chait. And that put them in a very tough situation. That put the Jews in a very tough situation because they had to now go out and collect the straw, which was very degrading. And not only that, but the thing was, and he still demanded the same amount of bricks. So it's really a tremendous increase. It's a tremendous increase in their labors. And they were subject to punishment if they didn't produce the required amount of bricks. So what happens is very interesting. The reaction, of course, was that this is a very tough situation. And it says that the foreman, because the Paro had appointed Jews themselves to be the overseers of the work, you know, they were responsible. They were responsible to see to it that the Jews produced the required amount. So they were flogged. They were punished. Because they couldn't produce the quota that was imposed upon them. So then it says, Vayavo showed Raven Israel that these foremen of the Jews came and they cried out to Paro, saying, "What are you doing? Why are you doing this to your servants? Straw is not being given to your servants. And they say to us, make bricks. Look, your servants are being flogged, and it is your people's fault." That's very interesting. First of all, you see from this that they had access to Paro. That's a very fascinating thing. You don't get that sense. I mean, the Jews are lowly, they're slaves, and so forth, and Paro's not going to meet with them. You wouldn't imagine that. And yet here we see, I guess they form some kind of delegation, and they come to Paro, and they put a complaint before Paro. And then he answers them. He says, you know, you're lazy. Nirpim atem, nirpim. You are lazy. Therefore you say, let us go and sacrifice to the Lord. I mean, that was his, he wanted to destroy the credibility of Moshe, obviously, in the eyes of the people, by showing them that they joined together with Moshe in this complaint or in this demand that they'd be given an opportunity to sacrifice. So this is what's making things worse. So he was saying that's because you're lazy and you don't want to work and you just want a vacation. So he says, now go to work. Straw shall not be given to you, but you must provide the total of bricks. The foreman of Israel saw their misery when they said, do not deduct from your daily due of bricks. Then they met Moshe and Aaron standing. Then that's when, I guess when they left, they bumped into Moshe and Aaron, facing them as they came out from Paro. They said to them, that is, they said to Moshe and Aaron, may the Lord look upon you and judge, for you have made us hateful in the eyes of Paro. That's an amazing, amazing kind of thing. And I think it illustrates what we're talking about over here, that the Jews did not view the situation the way we view it, because we see this whole episode that they go to Paro. First of all, how are you going to get an appointment with Paro? You're just a lowly slave, and they present their demands, and they present it kind of forcefully. That what are you doing to your servants? You're making it impossible for us to do the kind of work that we're supposed to do. Actually, Rabbi Chait said, because the way, see, Paro was intelligent. He was smooth in terms of how he was able to manipulate the Jews. And that is that when he provided the straw, so that maintained a certain element of prestige, that the Jews were artisans. So they made the bricks, they were artisans. But they themselves didn't have to go around, you know, collecting the straw. But now, they were degraded. And, of course, it was, practically speaking, it was almost impossible for them to do it, because it was just too much. And also, it was degrading, because they no longer could maintain that image that they had, that they weren't just ordinary slaves, but they were skilled artisans. So you see, in going to Paro and in making this appeal, apparently, they had convinced themselves that there was some element of justice over here, that there was a good reason, they had responsibilities they had to do, you know, they had obligations that they needed to do, and that ultimately they must, that Paro was he's reasonable. He would listen to them. And they did have access. The fact that they had access to Paro means that on a certain level he ran the situation in a way in which, yeah, you could present your complaints. He's not a brutal tyrant that you can't speak to. So you see that the Jews had ways of deceiving themselves. That's another element over here. That's why it's extremely difficult. Things had to reach such a point where they would be open to listening to Moshe. And of course, this was a setback. And see, at this point, it was a big setback. And that's when Moshe complained that you've made things worse. Now the people are not going to listen to me at all. Or I've made things worse. He blamed himself. But he couldn't understand that. Moshe couldn't understand why this would happen. Because this only made the situation more complicated. But you can see that the Jews had really assimilated into Egyptian society. And that's a very powerful phenomenon. That is, I mean, it's like Americans, you know, we're American Jews, like myself, all of us, we feel like we're Americans. And because that's a very significant thing. Because America, in addition to being a country that's good to the Jews, but it's a powerful country. It's like, at least until recently, the world's superpower, the most advanced country in the world, in every area. So that gives you a certain sense I'm an American. Now, there's Americans that are very successful at the top. There are Americans that are very lowly and may be on welfare, whatever it is, but they still have that security. It's a very powerful thing. You still have the security of being an American. And you don't want to give that up. You don't want to leave America. So it's not far-fetched to say that there were many Jews in Egypt, in spite of, the bad conditions that they experienced and so on and so forth, but they were Egyptians. You see that attitude. The attitude that they were Egyptians comes forth in the case of Dathan and Aviram, according to Chazal. They're fighting and Moshe tries to break it up. And then they rebuke him. Who are you? Who made you the judge? Are you going to kill us just like you killed the Egyptian? So that same attitude, that you're a murderer, you're a rebel, you killed an Egyptian, which shows that they identified with the system, you know, with the laws and of Egypt. So that makes sense. That there were Jews in Egypt who didn't want to leave in Yetzias Mitzrayim. To the contrary, once we think into it, we understand. That's not far-fetched. That's definitely possible. That's all right. That's the first point. So now the next question is: okay, So why did they have to be killed? What was the essence of that sin? I mean, so let them stay. You like it, so let them stay. I would say that the sin is that that's real denial of God. Because you put all your faith in Egypt. Al tiftachu b'nedivim. Do not put your faith in princes. B'van Adam. That is, we all have that feeling. Human might. That's the reason why we feel much more comfortable in America than in Israel. Because America. America is powerful. Although, as I said, we're not going into the what's going on in the country and whether it's the same country and all. That's a separate point. But there is a general feeling of security. You're putting your faith. So if they didn't want to go, that means that they didn't want to accept Hashem. And they didn't have, and as Libby points out, you see that those Jews who left were always struggling with that. That fear that they would not be able to be protected. And as bad as it was, let's appoint a leader and go back to Egypt. Because in Egypt, we had protection. The protection was Egypt, the king, the country. So that's really the ultimate denial. That's a form of avodah zarah. So for that, they deserved to be killed. Now, what's the next thing, though? So that's what that's the first 2 points in Rashi. That this was the problem. This was why we needed, there was a need for the Choshech. To settle an internal problem, so to speak. But what's the third point? That in order to do this, it had to be done, and the Egyptians shouldn't be cognizant of it. What's the reason for that? I mean, on a certain level, you could say, well, they should. They should see that that's the punishment, that's the penalty for not believing in Hashem. But go ahead. Because there was a conflict over here. And that is that, well, I mean, on a certain level, the point of the Makos was to drive home to the Egyptians that the denial of Hashem and to continue in their obstinate ways is going to bring down divine wrath, punishment, so to speak. Now, the fact that Jews also would be punished when they rebel against God, and on a certain level, that would strengthen the point. It's not just Egyptians. In a purely theoretical level, on a purely theoretical level, it would be good. Because they see that even Jews, that God doesn't have favorites, he doesn't play favorites, and everything depends upon your behavior. And the behavior that the Egyptians are engaged in is rebelling against the will of God, and they're going to suffer for it. And if they should see that not only us, but the Jews themselves, who do the same thing, are punished, on one level you could say, well, that's good. So that strengthens the point. But that's not the case, though. That is not the case, because it goes upon the perception. People are not going to see that. And when they're in a state of rationalization, so if they saw things happening to the Jews, they wouldn't derive the proper lesson. You see a similar phenomenon when Moshe prays to God by the Lama Yomer Mitzrayim, that if you kill the Jews, so then the Egyptians will say that there was some flaw in God or in his plan. He couldn't bring them into the land, and so on and so forth. But no, I mean, to the contrary, if they would see that God punished the Jews because they made the eagle, that would be good, because they would see that it's not that God has favorites with the Jews; it's that people who behave in that manner are punished, even Jews. So why is that a bad thing for the Egyptians? Because that's not the way they would look at it. They would not see things. That's a separate point. It's a very, very interesting point that even though the phenomenon itself is really a good one, contains very, very good lessons, but you see there's tremendous distortion. So people can't see certain things because they're going to distort it. If they were honest, if they had the honesty to look at the situation the way it is, they would see that it's a good thing. But the way people look at it, the phenomenon of rationalization takes over. And thus, if they were to see that the Jews were being punished, they wouldn't look into it. Because their emotions are basically to deny that what's happening to them is a result of the fact that they're sinning. And rather they were, that's what Paro, I mean, to deny it and to just attribute it to natural forces. It's not because, that's the battle that man is involved in. That when certain things go wrong in his life, which should cause him, which should induce him to look within, he doesn't look within. He doesn't want to do that. He doesn't want to say it's because of the way I'm living. He doesn't want to give that up. He doesn't want to deal with that. So therefore, he's going to attribute it to other things. And this is on many, many levels. That even when people suffer certain illnesses, and forget about sin, even on in terms of look at how you're living your lifestyle. Change your habits, nutrition and so on, or exercise, whatever it might be. People are tremendously reluctant. They don't want to look in to the situation because that would imply that they're doing things wrong and they'd have to change and do things in a way that they don't want to do it. So that's the idea over here, that there was a need to punish those Jews who basically were denying God by refusing to go along. And at the same time, while it would have been a good thing for the Egyptians to see this, but there are certain things you can't show to people. Certain truths have to be withheld from people because they're in a complete state of distortion and they would interpret those truths in the wrong way and come to the wrong conclusion. So this would interfere with the goal of the Makos. So therefore, according to Rashi, that was Choshech. Okay, but we'll continue. It's a fascinating point. We'll have to stop here. We'll continue. So take care. Have a good day. See you tomorrow.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, bye.
Bye.